You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Coming up on the program, we hear an interview with Jim Skop about a Dutch resistance fighter in World War II. Diet Eman died last week. Also, we'll hear some music from Sioux City musician Spencer Aspleaf. But first, a conversation with the founder of Ho-Chunk, Inc. This week is the 25th anniversary of the development arm of the Winnebago Tribe of Nebraska. The company began in 1994 with an immediate mission of creating jobs on the reservation and a long-term income for the tribe. At the time, symptoms of poverty were rampant and opportunities for economic growth were limited. Since then, the company's approach has evolved to develop both an economy and middle class on the reservation. Lance Morgan is a Winnebago tribal citizen who founded the company and continues as its president and CEO. Morgan says this milestone represents the progress that's been made as a community.
The Winnebago tribe has struggled in its modern history, you know, financially. You know, and that there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, we lost all our land. A lot of people were, you know, died from disease. We were displaced 7 times. You know, you can't do that to any group of people and then come out thriving. And then, so we started off rough, and then the government took control of all of our land too. And so there really was no easy way for our government to raise money through taxes or individuals to develop wealth through farming or home ownership or anything of the sort. It was all sort of hard to do in our world for lots of legal and structural reasons. And so when the tribe got a little bit of casino gaming money, we said, hey, this is a once in 6 or 7 generation opportunity for us. Let's not just count on gaming. Let's also diversify and see if we can do some other things in business. And so Ho-Chunk Inc. was established really to create job opportunities and an income stream for the tribe that wasn't gaming related. And so we started off with just, I guess, myself. And now we have 1,200 employees and we do stuff all over the world and we've become a much larger company. But the original reason was just to take some control of our own destiny, to create our own opportunities, and to make some money for ourselves that didn't come from the government.
I saw that Creighton University economist Ernie Goss, he studied some indicators of what has been accomplished. The numbers are quite impressive. Household income grew 83% from 2000 to 2016. The number of people living in poverty decreased 6%. Home ownership went up more than 8%. I mean, these are big things that have been accomplished.
Well, you know, if you look at the median income, it really is an impressive statistic. You know, home ownership jumped, poverty levels dropped, but you have to understand something about this. 300 of our housing units are reserved for low-income people. And so we have a built-in poverty base to those statistics. And so it's very hard to move the needle on those things. And because you have to build more housing in the community in order to adjust that. So a lot of times you'd have to leave the community if you started making more money because there wouldn't be housing for you. So a lot of effort has been put into building our own community up with new housing opportunities. And so statistically, we're doing great, but really we're doing much better than it even shows, I think, because if a median income jumps 83% and 300 of your 500 houses are reserved for low income, that means the people who are doing well are really doing well, you know, to help drag up that statistic that high. And so, you know, we're thrilled with what's happened, but we think that there is a lot more underlying it than even what it shows.
What would you like to do in the next 20, 25 years? And what do you see coming on?
Well, I'd like to be alive. I guess.
Me too. Yeah. So,
I started it when I was 25, 26, I guess. And so now it's 25 years later. You can do the math on that. But so if I was around 25 years, it'd be great. But what I really want to see happen, you know, they say the test is surviving the test of time. And I would hate to think that if Ho-Chunk wasn't here driving, you know, jobs and income and tax dollars and just economic activity for our community, you know, that would really be a burden on our community. And so I think Winnebago, we always find a way to be successful. I mean, we've been through a lot, but having a large scale, you know, corporate entity, you know, with sort of a community-based mindset, and you know, is a good thing for any community, and it's a huge thing for a community the size of Winnebago. And so what I want to see is Ho-Chunk continue to grow and continue to thrive. You know, people would have, no one would have bet on our success 25 years ago, you know, so we've sort of pulled off the miracle. And I think the job is now is just not to screw it up and just keep growing and keep being a steady contributor. I don't think we have to be the world's best anything. We just have to be the world's, we just have to be Winnebago's best company that we can be. And I think we're on our way to doing that.
And you're having an event to celebrate this afternoon, isn't that right?
Yes. One of the things we've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years is somebody said, you got to feed the people. And so, you know, any event that we have in our community, it tends to be, there tends to be some food involved in it. And so we used to sort of, we wanted to get more information out there. So we'd do these little slideshows, and while people were eating, they could learn a little bit more about the company. And we usually have pretty good attendance. I think it might be partially the door prizes are pretty nice. And so we invite people down, we feed them, they walk away usually with some sort of prize if they're lucky. And it turns out to be a really good event. There's lots of things for the kids to do, lots of games. It's almost like a small little festival atmosphere. And I think it's just a positive feel-good event. And we've done it the last several years, and it's really one of the highlights of the year, you know. And it fits into our tradition in terms of making sure people get information but also get fed.
That was Lance Morgan, president and CEO of Ho-Chunk Inc., which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this week. Ho-Chunk Inc. is an underwriter of Siouxland Public Media. Another Native American community has also been making strides economically: the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Marjorie Kelly talks about the changes at the reservation in her book, The Making of a Democratic Economy: How to Build Prosperity for the Many, Not the Few. Kelly and Ted Howard are principals for the nonprofit The Democracy Collaborative, a research and development lab for the democratic economy. Kelly presents the case of communities like Cleveland, Ohio, and Pine Ridge, where a new democratic economic system has been put in place, one that rejects the profit motive of capitalism. The Pine Ridge Reservation received nationwide attention after a beer store near the community in White Clay was shut down after protests over the concern over its effect on the residents of the reservation. And last month, South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem and the Ogallala County school officials announced a partnership to build the first public high school on the Pine Ridge Reservation. Marjorie Kelly says the school is just one sign that the Pine Ridge Reservation is creating what she calls a regenerative community that rewards workers who invest their time and energy in their jobs and the community.
Lakota Sioux has worked with others to start the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation, trying to get something going on this reservation where there's 80% unemployment. And every time a dollar comes on to the reservation, it leaves within 48 hours. So they listened to the community and said, what is it that you need? There were no houses, not a single house for sale on Pine Ridge back when they started. So they're building a regenerative community. They're going to build houses and rentals and places for business and for spiritual practices and youth recreation. And they're training youth in construction skills as they build these homes. And they created an employee-owned construction company. They're going to be doing solar energy, aiming to create all their own energy, recycle their water. So it's a remarkable demonstration project in a planned community built to serve all of us.
There have been a lot of efforts since the closure of the beer store by the Pine Ridge Reservation to try and make life better there. But it sounds like this particular project is a way of saying to the folks who live there, here, you can take control of your economic situation.
Yeah, that's absolutely essential. This is about empowerment. I mean, right now most of us feel at the whims of this big economy, which we don't understand and don't have any power in. 72% of Americans say that they think the economy is rigged against them, and they're right.
What kind of pushback do you get from this idea? Because I would assume some people would say, well, that's a wonderful idea in theory, but how is it going to work in practice? How is this possible?
Yeah, I think that is a key question, and that's why in the book, we we go around and we visit places where this is already arising. And then in each case, we talk about how this might go to scale. For example, Nick right now on his Pine Ridge regenerative community, he's now taking that model out to dozens of other Native communities. And so to get back to employee ownership, this is a model that's been around for decades. Ronald Reagan put in place tax incentives to encourage owners to sell to employees. And it's a proven model. There's more than 7,000 companies, or roughly 7,000 companies, that have some employee ownership. And studies show that workers at these companies, the employee owners, have assets average about $140,000 when they retire. And when you put in employee ownership, it can increase profits slightly, productivity somewhat. It can reduce turnover, and pretty dramatically. The risk of layoff is about 1/4 what it is at traditional companies. So these are companies that work, and they work at scale. In the UK, there's a company called the John Lewis Partnership. It has revenues of about $13 billion. It'd be on the Fortune 500 if it were publicly traded. It's 100% owned by its workers. It's the largest department store chain there, and has over 100 grocery stores. And it's been doing this for decades. It's 100% employee owned. So these models are proven. I think they're ready to go to scale. So you asked, how do people push back? I find, first of all, an eagerness and a readiness to hear about this, because people know what we have isn't working and they're hungry for alternatives. And that's on both sides of the political aisle. And I think where the pushback is, it's about despair and about hopelessness. People feeling, well, you know, these are nice ideas, but can we ever really get there? And that's a lot what the book is about. It's saying that we can take these steps together, and getting, knowing that it's possible is a first step.
That was Marjorie Kelly, the author of the book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, How to Build Prosperity for the Many, Not the Few. Kelly talked about the creation of democratic economic systems like the one being created at the Pine Ridge Reservation of the Ogallala Sioux in South Dakota. She spoke of the efforts of Nick Tilson, who is the CEO of the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation. Tilson is a citizen of the Ogallala Nation. Tilson is working to create a new economy in Pine Ridge, and he was also present at Standing Rock with the Indigenous People's Power Project and worked to train thousands of resistors on how to take nonviolent direct action against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, I'm Mary Hartnett. Buena Vista University in Storm Lake will soon be home to a new center focused on rural entrepreneurship. The founder of Casey's General Stores is giving close to $3 million to Buena Vista to get it started. The center will feature an idea incubator to help startups, an academic minor focused on rural entrepreneurship, and other resources for business people and students. Governor Kim Reynolds attended the launch event last week.
This center will offer diverse and vibrant pathways to ignite a movement in rural Iowa and rural Iowa entrepreneurship.
Governor Reynolds joined Buena Vista President Joshua Merchant at a ceremony in Des Moines last Wednesday to announce the Donald F. and Charlene K. Lamberti Center for Rural Entrepreneurship at BVU. Speaking on the road Monday, President Merchant said it was exciting to be able to address some of the issues affecting the rural areas surrounding the university and to encourage people to come up with innovative ideas to energize rural communities.
It's significant because it's allowing us to be able to put a stake in the ground and really focus on, you know, our geography and where we live, which is in rural Northwest Iowa. We were doing entrepreneurial studies, you know, no different than a lot of colleges and universities across the state of Iowa. And we really wanted to put our stake in the ground and do something different and to be able to focus on rurality and ruralism and in helping and supporting young people who want to go and make a life in rural, you know, Iowa and rural communities, to be able to help them be successful. And so that's why we started this program, and we're really excited about what it's going to be able to do.
So this is being called a rural business incubator, is that right?
Well, it's the Center for Rural Entrepreneurship.
Okay.
And an incubator is just one component of that, Mary. And so there's a number of pieces to this. One is the academic piece, which is a new academic minor that's being developed at the university. And another is a certification program and a series of workshops that'll be offered not only to current students, but to adult learners who are looking to go back and get some additional professional development. The third is an opportunity to provide students and community members a space, which an incubator would be a part of that, or which I like to call an innovation center, a think tank, a creative space. And so there's a number of different pieces to that.
So when you talk about helping students and helping the area sort of being this center for advancing life in a rural area, what are some of the things you think are really important with that? What are some of the things you think this gift will help you do?
One of the things that I'm really excited about, you know, is I think the natural inclination is that we all think, well, this is for people who want to have small businesses or who want to work in the business arena. And it's not just that. Because of our focus at the university on civic engagement, there's a big component to what we're doing around citizenship. So regardless if you're a business owner or you're a veterinarian or you want to work in rural health or you want to be a teacher, you know, there's a component to understanding what it means to be an active citizen in a rural community and how each of those different professions are part of making those communities not only survive but thrive.
Do you think this will also encourage, especially young people, to not want to flee not just Northwest Iowa, but the state?
That's exactly right. And there's just opportunity. And it's to get students to not only, you know, connect and partner with those, you know, rural communities, but to also be innovative and creative and think outside of the box and to think entrepreneurial themselves, you know, about what opportunities may be available, because living in a small, you know, to rural community is a great thing. You know, many people who know me would have heard me say, you know, a lot of times, I think rural is cool. And there's a lot of benefits to being able to live in a rural community. It has a good quality of life. It's a great place to build a professional career. It's a great place to raise a family. And we need to continue to promote and focus on those things.
I know BVU has really been a big part of rural life and political life. You've had political forums on the campus. I went up to a program up there about, you know, hunger and trying to deal with food insecurity. You really cover quite a lot of territory.
Yeah, you know, as a university, we should. And we continue to try to do that. And one of the things that I think is really great about Buena Vista University and other rural private institutions of higher education is that we've really provided an awesome opportunity to be able to have conversations, to be able to create dialogue, to really be able to provide our students and our community in which we live, you know, opportunities to hear from thought leaders and to take part in those activities. And I think it's just a great opportunity for BBU and Storm Lake and in the region.
Do you know when, how or when this will sort of start to, the money will start being used?
You know, we've hired a new director for the center. And so that has started. Gary Sterling, who's in place and he's helping, you know, work to build and find a space for us in downtown Storm Lake, which will house the Center for Rural Entrepreneurship. And then we've hired a new faculty member as well, who's going to work to build out the curriculum. And so those two things are in place. Is, you know, the Lambertis have been so wonderfully supportive of the university over the years. We really want to make sure we steward their gift in a thoughtful and manner so that we can put their gift into action.
That was the president of Buena Vista University in Storm Lake, Josh Merchant. Merchant talked about the many ways the school and the community would benefit from a $3 million gift from the founder of Casey's General Stores that will focus on rural issues and also create an incubator for rural entrepreneurship. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. In the last few years, complaints about the lack of civility in daily life, at work and at play, have been numerous. And some say President Donald Trump is setting a bad example. Others say the lack of civility is a symptom of a larger problem in society. Last Friday on the Iowa State University campus in Ames, journalists and others gathered to talk about the issue of civility, the media, and social media. Leslie Gaines Ross, chief reputation strategist for a New York-based public relations firm, presented her findings at that forum from the Civility in America study. I spoke with Gaines from her office on Monday. Gaines Ross says most Americans blame social media for incivility at work and online.
And I think what's truly amazing about that is when we, as I said, we've been following that for quite a while, and we started asking about social media in 2012, and the number was about 24% of Americans said that social media, the internet, was responsible. Here we are, 2019, it's more than doubled. So social media is at the top of the list, followed by the White House, followed by politicians in general, and then followed at a lower level, the news media. So there are many factors that are all converging to create this incivility environment. But right now, there seems to be Americans are pointing the finger at social media and the internet.
Do you think that it's, in a way, convenient to say point the finger at social media? Because social media it's us. It's people. People are doing this. But social media provides an outlet where you can go on there, and sometimes you can go on there and be anonymous and say terrible things and cause a lot of problems for people without ever having to, you know, face any consequences.
I think that it reflects reality in the sense that there's also a sense that our institutions and social media companies should do something about how social media is used. And we're starting to see that in the past couple of years, certainly in last year, about some of the big companies are trying to eliminate hate language and videos that are really hateful. So I think, yes, it's people. It's people like all of us who are maybe using social media to be uncivil. But I think it is interesting because a few years ago, I would say, going back 5-7 years ago, there was a belief that social media and the internet helped connect us, helped us learn and gain information. So I think that we're seeing that today in our study, in fact, that Americans say that social media is playing a more negative role than a positive role. And I think we, as Americans, saw more positivity years ago. So I think something is definitely changing, certainly with fake news and a lot of the hate that seems to be living on the internet.
That was Leslie Gaines Ross, chief reputation strategist for a New York-based public relations firm, talking about the findings from a recent study about civility in America. I spoke with Gaines Ross from her office earlier this week. You're listening to The Exchange, and I'm Mary Hartnett. Sioux City's Calvary Cemetery Mausoleum commemorated its 100th anniversary Saturday, September 7th, with a blessing from Bishop Walker Nicholas. The mausoleum is located in Sioux City's only Catholic cemetery just off Military Road near Riverside. Also on Saturday, Walt Peterson, the executive director of the cemetery, gave a half-hour history lesson about the cemetery and the mausoleum. The 500-crypt mausoleum was designed by William Steele. Steele designed many of the city's most prominent buildings, including the Davidson Building, the Livestock Exchange, and the Woodbury County Courthouse. Steele is buried up the hill from the mausoleum that he created. Walt Peterson says many of Sioux City's early prominent citizens are buried at Calvary Cemetery.
I saw also Maritralia is here. A lot of people know about the Maritralia Community House, and she was did amazing things as a woman here to help people.
Yeah, she was an advocate for minorities way ahead of her time. Amazing woman.
Whenever I'm up here and my family's buried a few steps away from Tommy Boland's grave, and you were saying it's the most visited grave up here, and I would attest to that because every time we're here, there are so many mementos up there, except maybe in the, you know, dead of winter, there are always people leaving things for him.
Yeah, and it still happens. They'll stop the guys on the mowers, or they'll come get me and say, can you help me find Tommy Boland? Because it's a flush with the ground, so sometimes it can be a little difficult to find if you're not familiar with it. And it happens still frequently. And after this many years, that's really a testament to his talent.
You talked a lot about the importance of history and memory and how, you know, today Catholics can be cremated and are cremated and they're buried up here. You know, as opposed to sort of spreading ashes, a lot of people like to do that. But when you have a memorial, when you have a marker, when you have a resting place, people learn about you and your life. And that was something I hadn't really thought a lot about.
And I don't think that information gets to people nowadays. I think that just the scattering is so convenient and easy. Well, it's favorite fishing spot or whatever. But after working out here this many years, I've seen so many people come out, and the healing process, the cemetery is a big part of the healing process, and I've seen it a lot of times, and I just recommend it.
But of course, this is a Catholic cemetery, and there are things about this cemetery that are unique.
Especially because this is a Catholic cemetery, the clergy and the bishops and the nuns are all buried out here. Just for one example, the nuns, you know, there's fewer and fewer nuns and sisters around, and that part of history can be explained by just walking the grounds and seeing the number of nuns that are interred out here. So.
And you mentioned Mother Gertrude. I heard you on another program on Friday talking about Mother Gertrude, who, wasn't she the one who was behind the creation of St. Vincent Hospital? Is that right?
That's my understanding, yes.
You've made it possible for people, though, to come up here and find their loved ones. You have a computer up here. People can go into sort of the new mausoleum chapel just up the hill here. And I've done that and found some of my family members. And I kind of remembered where they were because my grandparents knew where they were, but sometimes after they die, you forget and you can't find them.
And especially as time goes on, it becomes more difficult the further back they are. But that's a big part of my job, is helping people locate their ancestors.
Yeah. Are you ever surprised in the interest people have?
Not really surprised, but happily impressed. Yeah, that there's an interest in the history and of the cemetery, because they kind of get a bad name sometimes. They think, well, that's a spooky old cemetery. It's really not a spooky old cemetery. This is somebody's mom's, brother's, dad's. It's all family is what it is.
That was Walt Peterson, the sexton of Calvary Cemetery. The mausoleum at the Catholic Cemetery was built 100 years ago last week. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. On September 3rd, 2019, Diet Eman died at the age of 99. Eman, originally a bank teller from Holland, was hailed as a resistance hero during World War II. Here's Diet in her own words.
Evil comes, you have to take a stand. I mean, you see it, and then you have to trust God for whatever happened. And it's true that can cost your life. I say, now we have to take a stand. And here people sometimes are laid off if they take a stand. But that's what you have to do. You can't follow the crowd. You have each for yourself. You have to answer to God.
Following the fall of Holland to Hitler's army, Diet and her fiancé, Hein Seitzma, risked their lives for their beliefs. They would later be sent to concentration camps for their acts. Diet survived. Hein didn't. Deet came to the U.S. and made her home in Michigan, telling her story. Author Dr. Jim Skop listened and offered to be her biographer. Deet eventually took him up on that offer. In 1994, Dr. Skop helped Deet write her autobiography, Things We Couldn't Say. A few years ago, Dr. Skop talked to Siouxland Public Media's Mark Munger about Deet's journey.
The story of Deet Amon, it's a great story because it fits this particular, I think anyway, one of the designations of great stories, and it is, it's a love story set up against great human tragedy. Mm-hmm. And the great human tragedy is, of course, the Second World War, and they're in love, and they lose. So it's Romeo and Juliet, you know. On the other hand, she withholds her, or holds on to her basic faith in humanity and faith in God as well, that carry her through and all that sort of stuff.
The Dutch general had little choice. To save the lives of innocent civilians, he accepted the German terms. But after the unconditional surrender, the Nazis bombed the city anyway.
1940, you know, basically what happened is that the Nazis came in and wiped out Holland in a matter of 3 days and really put the clincher on when they bombed Rotterdam and just annihilated the city. They occupied Holland, and no one really knew exactly what that was going to be, but the systematic means by which the Nazis simply created their occupying force made it very clear in just a little while that there was going to be a problem with Jews. And the Jewish people of the Netherlands knew that ahead of time. There was a significant number of Jewish people who were living in Holland who had already left Germany in 1933 at Kristallnacht, or later at night Kristallnacht, and understood that this was part of the pattern. Mm-hmm. So it didn't take long, and certain people, and it just so happens that her boyfriend had read Mein Kampf, and her boyfriend sort of said to her, this is not good. We're going to be faced with moral questions that are not going to run away from us, and mm-hmm. we have to start thinking about it. And then her friend, who she worked with at the bank, was Jewish, and he was told, you know, report to the city park with one suitcase at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'm not quoting her now, but it was to that effect. And he knew that it meant a kind of deportation. He didn't really know exactly what it meant. So he said to her, should I go? And then she came back to her boyfriend and said, you know, how can we let this happen? And he said, well, my father, you know, lives up in this, in terms of this world, you know, mm-hmm. lives up in Sioux County up there by a bunch of farmers. And I know good people up there, and good people will take some of these people. Of course, they thought the war would last 6 weeks, and that's all. Mm-hmm. So their job became taking Jewish people out of the city of Den Haag, the Hague, and bringing them to rural outlying areas where they were hidden then, and for the rest of the war, for, you know, 4 years.
Could I actually have you read that sure. part?
So I went to Hein, my fiancé, and I asked him what could be done, and Hein said he could hide Herman out in the country in the Veluwe, where his father was the headmaster at a small Christian school in Hoek, Gelderland. There were all farmers around there, all Christian people, and they would certainly hide Herman. We thought the war would last only a year or so, no more. We thought that certainly Roosevelt would come in and end all of this. After all, it was the 20th century, and this man Hitler, this little maniac, was a barbarian. Oh, Deet, this is not the Dark Ages. We live in the modern age. And then Deet says, well, shall we then? And Hein says, well, I can find him a place. That's no problem. It's very risky. Deet, if we don't, when this is all over, you and I will not be able to look at each other in the face for what we didn't do.
One of the things that stuck out to me in reading that was that idea that we live in modern times, and surely Roosevelt will come in and stop that. And I've never heard somebody just come out right and say, oh, this is a modern time that we live in. There's no way this little maniac can get away with this. It takes the theater out of the life that they were living, to me. It's not at all looking back. It's they're fully looking forward and thinking the world is going to get better.
You know, adjectives, you sort of lose adjectives in any talk of the Holocaust because nothing quite works. But some of the most fascinating stories come out of people who were in fact hiding Jewish people up in the country. Because basically, you know, if you follow the old Mark Twain dictum of fish and guests both stink after 3 days, to think of these people, many times incredibly sophisticated, well-educated Jewish people from the city, living out in the manure, so to speak, in the middle of rural areas, and then always hiding because mm-hmm. they couldn't come out. They had to do everything they could to cover the fact that there were people even in the house, mm-hmm. but they were there for 4 years. And sometimes simply the personality differences themselves had to be negotiated because there was no way out. They couldn't just say, well, I'm going to put you on the road. Mm-hmm. You know, that couldn't happen. So they had to sort of figure out a way of coexisting. And mm-hmm. those are terribly interesting stories in terms of just the human dynamics of the way in which we get along with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And just under such conditions, under the pressures conditions. Outside the yeah. house.
Mm-hmm. And could the kids know? That was mm-hmm. always a big question, you know, how old the kids have to be before they get to understand that we actually have a guest or two or three, because little kids are going to go tell other little kids, well, we have people in our house, and that many times mm-hmm. then the jig was up.
The other moment in what you read that struck me as a new thought for me was how the movement developed. I mean, these people weren't necessarily part of a movement until suddenly they were, and they had to find the other people that were sympathetic to their ideas. Yeah. I mean,
that's where the title comes from, actually. You know, I'm writing this whole book or piecing together the stories that she tells, and all of a sudden it struck me that there were so many things they couldn't say that they, and if I'm, can I just tell you an anecdote that's not even in the play? So what happens in one of them, for instance, is this Deep goes, she discovers that there's three little girls, little Jewish girls, and they need a place. And it's late in the war, and it's hard to find places anymore. So she goes to the house of a clergyman, of a Protestant clergyman, a Dutch Reformed clergyman, as a matter of fact, walks up to the door, and she knew that he would be sympathetic enough not to turn her in. So she says to him, you know, I've got these three darling little, I don't know if she said darling, we've got these three little girls, and I don't have a place for them. You've got to take them in. And he says, no. And she said, what, you know, look at them, purely innocent, and you can't take them? And he said, no, I can't take them. And it went on and on for a while. And it's one of the few times that I remember she said, I swore at him, you know, what is wrong with you? You know, don't you have a heart? And finally walked away, and it wouldn't take. Well, after the war, what she discovered was that he already had a whole house full of Jews, and he couldn't tell her. You know, because essentially, in many cases, when you operated in the underground like that, there were things you didn't want to know, because the things that you did know would put your life into more jeopardy, into more stark, tragic sort of positions. So, you know, you wouldn't say. There were so many things that couldn't be said.
Thank you.
That's author Dr. Jim Skop, a retired professor at Dort College in Sioux Center, talking about the amazing life of Diet Eman, who recently died at the age of 99. Dr. Skop also wrote a biography of Diet Eman's life. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Singer-songwriter Spencer Aspleaf grew up in Sioux City. The 28-year-old is a member of the band Port Nocturnal, and he recently sat down with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer with his guitar to talk about his full-time musical career.
Travel around a bit. For instance, like a couple weeks ago, I played at the Sioux Empire Fair in Sioux Falls. That was a really cool gig. I played there for like 4 days. I play, you know, around town, occasionally go out to Omaha, Des Moines area. So it's just a, you know, just got to kind of keep playing shows.
A lot of young people, especially if they have the talent that you have, they kind of pick up and maybe decide to go to the Omaha area or Denver area or some other city.
I did live in Denver for a couple of years, and I played around there for a little bit, and I had a lot of fun. I actually came back here and kind of got sucked into being in Port Nocturnal. I was going to go live in Florida and play with another band, but I got kind of drawn back in with my friends to play with them, and I like my decision that I made. But like, for instance, like next week I'm going to Chicago, and like I don't have any like shows lined up, but I'm gonna hit up all the open mics and just go do that, and so just try to get into different markets, different networks.
That's great. And you, like you said, you're a band member of Port Nocturnal, but this summer you actually released a solo album.
I'm pretty excited about that. Born to Lose, you can find it anywhere on, you know, Spotify, iTunes. You can also email me or go on my website and get it off of there as well.
What's your website?
SpencerAspleafMusic.com.
And is your perspective broke? Like falling fruit from a tree.
And I'm looking at some of these song titles, Loaded Gun, Coyotes, of course, the title song, Born to Lose, and About You.
Yep.
What are these songs about?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends on what's the song it is, you know what I mean? So there are some of them, you know, are about like relationships. Some of them are about my friends' stories that they told me. You know, some of them are about like loss and different things like that. So it's just kind of whatever is inspiring me at the moment to write about. I usually try to, it's a good outlet for me to write how I feel. I feel like I don't express myself with words very well. So if I get to play, I can, you know, I get more expressive.
Just in the short time that I've gotten to know you, a very, very short time, you seem like a kind of a shy guy.
I mean, I have my moments. Like, I'm pretty laid back. I do get kind of like nervous or, you know, shy, but sometimes I can be, you know, the complete opposite. It really just depends on the day.
And when it comes to music, who inspires you to write these songs or to continue doing music?
I mean, I just really love to play. I've always played. I've been playing for a long time. I've been playing since I was about, I think I got my first guitar when I was 11, and really started playing it when I was about 12, 13. I just stopped doing all the sports and snowmobiles and dirt bikes. I just started playing guitar. And I've just kind of loved it ever since. I never really thought, like, when I was growing up, I was like, I'm going to be, you know, I've always wanted to be, but I never thought I was going to just be a musician. But so it's kind of seemed far-fetched, but now I'm doing it, and it's like, oh, this is pretty cool. So I'm having a great time with it.
How about the singing? You have just this amazing voice. You were a musician first and then fell into the singing, or how did that transpire?
Yeah, I've always
transpire?
Sang. When I was younger, I went to Catholic school for a little bit, and I got really into, like, I liked to go to church when I was younger because everybody would sing together, and I really liked the way that it sound. So like when I was younger, I remember just like going to church just to sing. And then I got older and I was like, whoa, I can play guitar and do this too, you know? So like, I don't know. I've just always been inspired by just different types of music. So it's just whatever I'm kind of, you know, feeling. So I've had a musical upbringing. I feel like my mom was a concert promoter, for instance. So she used to take me around sometimes to go to different shows and stuff. And that was kind of why I'm probably into it too. I'm not sure.
What shows did she work on?
She actually did Saturday in the Park for the longest time. She used to do, I think she helped with Jazz Fest in Sioux Falls. She's done the Governor's Ball before. She's done like Bob Dylan, Willie Nelson. I think she helped bring B.B. King here.
The sound that you're listening to is from my guitar that's named Lucille.
I'm pretty proud of her, so I think it's kind of cool. But so I got a lot of exposure to, I feel like, good music and good concerts through her and, you know, her friends and stuff like that. So I feel like I had a pretty lucky lifestyle with it. So,
and speaking of things that you're exposed to, I was reading in the Sioux City Journal that there's a song by Tommy Bolin that you really enjoy. And that's a song I think is a pretty amazing song.
Thank you.
And you have a cover of it. Do you think you could play a little bit of Wild Dogs for us? Is that possible?
I could totally try. I got my 12 string here.
Okay.
So we'll try it out. Baggage handcuffed to my wrist, I drag it everywhere I go. Sometimes I fight it with my fists, but if I knew which way it was home, that's where I'd go. If I knew which way it was home.
Anything unusual that no one really knows about you?
When I was 16, I was really getting into guitar or whatever, and I got my hand caught in a table saw. I was in woodworking class, and I actually lost my index finger halfway, and so it's just kind of stuck in like a weird position. So I had to relearn how to play the guitar. So it took a long time, but it was kind of a weird fact that I have a crooked finger. So it's kind of weird.
And you're still able to play.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. I have to do like different, it took me a while to get it. I have to do like different chord shapes. Like, and so like, instead of doing like bar chords, I have to like kind of throw my thumb over and do some jimmy chords and stuff like that. Different kind of blues chords and stuff. But I mean, it works out, so it's fun.
All run down, go trail, no chance for love, no sign of life. Just wild dogs howling in the night.
What would be the future that you would like for yourself?
I mean, I would just like to live comfortably. Like, you know, that'd be cool. Like, just playing music and living comfortably, having my own house. Like, maybe like an acreage with my dog that I have sit next to me. That'd be kind of nice. But I mean, like, I'm super content with where I'm at as well. Like, I feel like I don't do too bad. And I mean, I obviously have drive to do better. But like, you know, I'm pretty much happy with whatever I got going on.
Run down, go astray, no chance for love, no sign of life. Just wild dogs howling in the night.
That's local singer-songwriter Spencer Aspleaf, who besides solo shows is a member of the band Port Nocturnal. Thanks to Spencer for talking with us and bringing along his dog, Halle Berry's. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. And now here's a little more from Spencer Aspleaf, his song, Here's Getting Out of This.
And it's been hours and it's been days that I sat and laid to waste. Spent some time running through the sand, but now I'm here holding your hand. And all I got is all I can say when our nights get cold and gray. And when we're fighting, darling, and you're upset, just know we ain't getting out of this.